From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made this past Wednesday when the Deputy Foreign Minister of Russia, Sergei Ryabkov, said in a state-run interview that the Russian government did indeed have contacts with the Trump team during the presidential campaign. Mr. Ryabkov said, quote, "Obviously, we know most of the people from his entourage. We have just begun to consider ways of building dialogue with the future Donald Trump administration," end quote. And in response, Trump spokeswoman Hope Hicks denied that, saying that the campaign did not have contact with Russian officials before last Tuesday's voting. Writing in Esquire magazine, Charles Pierce says this story should dominate news coverage before Trump's inauguration, and it should confirm suspicions that Trump has been dangerously close to the regime of Vladimir Putin. Well, this morning, a Connections listener wrote that there's too much discussion about what we don't yet know. In other words, people who claim concern about a Trump presidency or people who claim optimism are basing all of it on speculation. We don't know what he will do, after all. And that's correct. We don't. It's possible that some of the concern or some of the optimism will be for naught. What we want to do is bring voices who can help us understand the proposals from the campaign or the actions from the campaign juxtaposed with policy as it emerges alongside President-elect Trump's selections for his cabinet. Tomorrow, we're going to sit down with small business owners who voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. Later this week, we'll welcome women, particularly white women who supported the next president. We'll also discuss what happens if Roe v. Wade is overturned, something that Trump acknowledged is possible when he sat for an interview that aired last night on 60 Minutes. But this hour, our focus is on foreign policy, Russia, trade, and more. And my guest is Dr. Randy Stone. He's the director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. And Randy, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan. Good to be with you again.
I suspect we've got plenty to talk about. I'll let our listeners know any questions or comments you have on the foreign policy side. You can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 this hour. You can find me on email and on Twitter as well. And Randy, I'll start with just those remarks that made headlines from the Deputy Foreign Minister of Russia, Sergei Ryabkov, just saying that, yes, they'd been in contact. That's something that's been disputed by the Trump campaign and now the Trump transition team. Why does this matter?
Well, it's a bit of a lapse of diplomatic protocol, I think, for him to say that. But it's interesting. I think I mentioned before we started that I've met Sergei Ryabkov in Moscow. He strikes me as a very level-headed, ordinary Russian foreign policy official. He's usually pretty guarded, but he's not the sort of person who would be likely to make up a wild story.
Okay. And so some of Trump's acolytes say, well, so what? You know, I mean, he has relationships with people around the world. He is going to be maybe better positioned to have a strong relationship with Putin and maybe a healthy one. Is that possible? Or should we be concerned, as Charles Pierce writes in Esquire, that this was a breach that should give us all kinds of pause?
Well, there have been lots of things that give us a lot of pause, but I guess I just see it as one more piece of evidence accumulating that Donald Trump has an unusual relationship with the authorities in Moscow. He seems to have financial liabilities vis-a-vis banks that are close to Putin and his entourage. He had people very close to him in his campaign, Paul Manafort particularly, who at one point was his campaign chairman, who was deeply involved in Russian politics and had been the former campaign manager for Viktor Yanukovych, the former dictator of Ukraine. So he has kind of an unhealthy degree of connection with some rather unsavory elements in Russia. And so it's likely that this will color his foreign policy towards Russia, and he might even be vulnerable to some personal pressure from the side of Russia.
Now, to be fair, maybe the Trump campaign would say, you've got it backwards. Those relationships that he has gives him leverage, gives him a chance to get in the room and exert some force of will or some direction on policy, or, you know, whether it's our direct relationship with Russia or Russia's behavior influencing other actors. Is there any hope that his relationship could have a positive influence?
Well, I don't think there's any hope that his his business dealings with Russia will give him influence over Russia. Quite the opposite, and he's on the vulnerable side of that transaction. You have to owe a lot more money than he currently owes to really have leverage of that sort. But it is possible that U.S.-Russian relations will significantly improve. We've been stuck on it in a number of ways. Part of the reason we were stuck was because of the personal animosity that I think Vladimir Putin felt towards Obama. And so there was some hope, whoever was the next president, that at least that obstacle would be gone. And perhaps we could get back to a more pragmatic relationship between the two countries. There are a lot of things which U.S. foreign policy and Russian foreign policy have been at loggerheads over, and the biggest one is Ukraine. The remarkable thing is it looks like Trump is going to reverse our policy on Ukraine. I don't know how far that will go, but he's indicated on the campaign trail that he was not interested in providing the kind of support for Ukraine that the Obama administration has in its conflict with Russia.
Well, we're going to talk about that coming up here, along with NATO, which you might have heard Dr. Stone discuss on this program leading up to last Tuesday's election. But let me just back up for a second and say that I read a very interesting kind of an exit interview. They called it the ultimate exit interview, Doris Kearns Goodwin and President Obama, that's online now. And in that interview, President Obama discusses some of his regrets, or at least his feeling on where he might have fallen short. He brings up Syria, and I'm curious to know, apart from Syria, or maybe if you can talk Syria if you'd like, but look at Russia, look at Ukraine. If you were to ask him how he would grade himself on Russia and Ukraine, or if you're grading him, or if you look back at his last 8 years and wish he had done certain things differently, how does he stack up with Russia, with Ukraine, and then perhaps as it relates to Syria?
President Obama.
Yes.
You know, well, I think he faced a set of extraordinarily difficult dilemmas here. There was no good response to the series of Russian escalations in Ukraine. We did not want to get involved in a war with Russia in Ukraine. Short of that, it's hard to see how we could have been much more forceful than we were. Russia was already has committed itself so far to its aggression against Ukraine that there wasn't a moderate deal to be struck, and I think the Obama administration negotiated that pretty carefully by imposing sanctions that were painful enough to perhaps give pause to the Russian regime, and yet not so painful that they forced Putin into a corner that would force him to escalate. Syria is another situation that was very tough. The Obama administration was attempting to deal with an ongoing humanitarian crisis, a very repressive regime that used chemical weapons against its own population and continues to do so, an intractable civil war, and no good alternative on the ground. And so we keep trying to cultivate allies of one sort or another there, but none of them are very reliable. And so the bottom line was we weren't sure that we wanted any of the various factions, really, to win that war. Perhaps the best strategy in that situation is just to stay out, but there wasn't any good solution.
He has said, and President Obama, I should say, has said that yes, he was almost pushed to the precipice of putting us much more involved in Syria with the whole red line comments and chemical weapons and the going back to 2013, and that he doesn't regret making that decision not to follow through with the war in Syria. In other words, we could have had a lot more boots on the ground. We could have been involved in another intractable ground war in the Middle East, and he didn't do that. And yet, I think a lot of Trump voters looked at that and said, well, he looked weak there. Or, you know, that was a moment where, you know, he should have exerted some kind of strength. And now I'm looking at what Donald Trump might bring to the White House. And I'm curious to know if this is just an unsophisticated view or if you think this lines up with reality. With President Obama, he didn't want war with Russia when Crimea happened, when Ukraine escalated. But he also didn't want to look, you know, like an appeaser. It's a very hard middle ground. Whereas Trump has spent this campaign talking almost flippantly about nuclear armament. Japan, Korea's talking about Ukraine, almost a, hey, that's not our job, fend for it yourself, NATO. Is it more likely that Putin will behave similarly as he has with Obama, but with even less concern that there would be reprisal? Because now President Trump has indicated, you know, in so many ways, we've been policing too much or doing too much, carrying the load for others.
Well, that's the cost of uncertainty, right? Mm. American foreign policy has been based upon credible commitments, rock steady commitments to our allies, to a set of objectives that we've built and invested heavily in a commitment to not backing away from. So NATO is one of those, and the most central of those. So the key to European security since 1955 has been Article 5 of NATO, which commits the United States and commits other NATO members to come to the defense of any NATO member who's threatened. This is something that Putin has openly talked about as being a dead letter. And it's something that is discussed privately by Russian elites as being something that isn't seen as being credible, that the United States would actually go to war in the 21st century to defend Latvia, Lithuania, or Estonia, the small Baltic states that are former republics of the Soviet Union but are now members of NATO and members of the European Union. Well, we're committed by treaty to do that if they're attacked by Russia. So this puts us in a potentially dangerous situation. And if conflict with Putin flares in the future, either because of something that the United States does or because Putin decides that it's useful for domestic purposes or that it's necessary in order to gain more leverage vis-a-vis Ukraine or for a variety of other reasons, that would be the soft spot that he would be inclined to push on. Those are countries that have substantial Russian populations, and so his tactics of using Russian soldiers in civilian clothes and pretending that they're local citizens would be attractive there. And so it's possible to imagine very dangerous scenarios spinning out of control, which would not happen if we were very clear about what our priorities are.
Are our NATO allies concerned about this election result?
Our NATO allies are really quite worried about it. I think NPR was just reporting about Jens Stoltenberg's comments over the weekend. The EU foreign ministers had an emergency meeting over the weekend to decide what to do about Trump. So they're very nervous about, you know, what this means about U.S. foreign policy. Now, these are all things that Donald Trump could lay to rest if he appoints Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, National Security Advisor, and so forth, who are well-known and respected abroad. And if he makes clear that, well, those were just loose comments on the campaign trail, American foreign policy hasn't changed. It will take some time. Some damage has been done nonetheless to the credibility of those commitments. But I think that should be the first priority going forward, is to try to repair some of the damage in terms of expectations abroad.
So what President Trump could do is make his own statements about those issues while also appointing people to serve in his cabinet who would signal to the world that some of those comments and the incendiary comments in the campaign were just that. They were just rhetoric. And again, now we get into speculation, but I think this is where it's valuable to at least talk about this, because unlike, you know, some of the criticism that we're just speculating now and we all have to sit back and see, I think with this much uncertainty, it behooves us to have vigorous public discussion before something happens in the idea that maybe we can have a hand in driving some of the result here. So John Bolton, Newt Gingrich, what would be the signal to the world if either one of them is chosen as Secretary of State?
Well, John Bolton has been UN ambassador,
yep.
And he was not one who was reassuring to our allies, but he's a known quantity. And he, you know, is an old cold warrior who I think would be reassuring in the context of a Trump presidency because he would be a known quantity. Newt Gingrich is more of an unknown quantity on foreign policy. He has a lot of crazy ideas. He's kind of, I think that would be rather worrisome around the world. There were a couple of, you know, announcements over the weekend that Reince Priebus is going to be the White House Chief of Staff, yeah. And that Stephen Bannon, on the other hand, is going to be a special advisor. And those convey opposite information, right? Reince Priebus is a conventional Republican politician that was reassuring. Stephen Bannon, the editor of Breitbart, is a leading figure in the alt-right movement, an extremist in every respect, and the outcry was immediate from across the political spectrum that, you know, this is really quite destabilizing. So it looks likely that we're going to have a pattern of governance that looks something like The Apprentice, where you have dueling teams of representing different positions, and Trump gets to rule on a case by case basis amongst them.
Let me be more charitable to the next president. Isn't that the Lincoln paradigm, team of rivals?
That would be a very positive spin to put on it.
You're not buying it.
No, I'm not buying it. I think this is incoherent. What I think you really need at this point in time, after a campaign like this and the kind of uncertainty that this president has created, is a lot of reassurance. So you need to appoint a Treasury Secretary who's going to reassure the markets, and you need to appoint a Secretary of State who's going to reassure the allies. You need to start mending some of those fences.
We're talking to Dr. Randy Stone. He's the director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester, about the next administration that's coming in and some of the uncertainty in regards to policy going forward. So, listeners, if you want to call in and weigh in here, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Let me kind of open it to you to some degree, Randy, to kind of take us where you're either concerned or optimistic. And I know the international trade and finance is sort of high on your list here in terms of what you're looking at going forward with this next administration. Explain.
So where the big concern going forward is what happens to America's role in the international trading system. You know, this is a system that the United States created together with our allies, but primarily it was our creation after World War II. And it was something that we thought was in our interest and was also necessary in order to rebuild the economies that were shattered after the war and try to create some stability in Europe. It's then expanded to the rest of the world. And the World Trade Organization includes most of the world's countries now. So we have an remarkably integrated world economy, right? It's no longer possible to say that an American car was manufactured in the United States, right? It's created by a global value chain which extends around the world. In particular, we are very integrated with Mexico, right? So our economy is deeply dependent upon the health of the Mexican economy and vice versa. So what happens if the next president is really committed to renegotiating all of these trade deals and upsetting all of these apple carts? It could be very upsetting to international financial markets and could lead to serious dislocations in the rest of the world.
When do you think we'll start getting a signal as to that?
Well, it'll help when we see who the cabinet appointees are. And it'll be interesting to see how the Senate politics of the confirmation process plays out. It's possible that the Republican leadership will decide to change the rules around the filibuster and to reduce the weight of the Democratic minority. I suspect that they won't want to do that. And I think the main reason that they won't want to do that is that they will want to contain Donald Trump's instincts about who he appoints to these positions. And they'll want to be able to hide behind the Democrats and blame the Democrats for slowing down appointees that they really hope that he doesn't make. So that process, as it plays out, will help to shape the complexion of the administration, which will then determine what are really going to be the priorities that that Trump tries to move on.
Well, you've been talking about, and I think a lot of people are talking about, what we already know in terms of who he has appointed and whom he might appoint and what that might signal. And I thought Dan Dresner in the Washington Post had an interesting article that kind of sums up some of the debate going on about who serves the Donald Trump administration. And I want to read part of what Ross Douthat wrote for the New York Times. Dresner sort of cataloging this debate that's going on, which says essentially the following, and I'm going to try to sum it up as accurately as I can. If you go throughout this political campaign, there weren't a whole lot of people in the foreign policy establishment who were on board with the Trump campaign. Is that fair, Randy?
That's true.
Okay. So he did not have a lot of people in his inner circle who were respected in the foreign policy realm.
There were large numbers of people who are respected in the Republican administration establishment who signed petitions and so forth opposing him.
Okay. And so now the question is that now that he's president, can some of the brightest minds, no matter their political background, the most well-respected people, can they go to work for him? Is there a cost to their reputation? Is there a cost to their future career beyond a Trump administration if you work for someone whom you don't respect or you have concerns about? And Max Boot, Ross Douthat, Dan Dresner have been debating this. I want to read from Ross Douthat, who is a conservative columnist for the New York Times, on why he is very much hoping that some of the best and brightest will set aside any differences and serve Donald Trump. Here it is. Quote, for the next 4 years, the most important check on what we've seen of Trump's worst impulses, his hair-trigger temper, his rampant insecurity, his personal cruelty, won't come from Congress or the courts or the opposition party. It will come from the people charged with executing the basic responsibilities of a government within his administration. This is particularly true in foreign policy, where presidential power has its fewest limits, where the chief executive can start wars with near impunity, deal out death from the skies, rattle the global economy with an executive order, and decide with barely anyone else's input to launch a nuclear weapon. In foreign policy, too, the choices that presidential appointees have to make on their own, in diplomatic and military contexts, can have life or death consequences very quickly. So to the extent that Trump's approach to governance threatens world peace, that threat can be mitigated by appointees with experience and knowledge and magnified if their posts are filled by hacks and sycophants instead. And Douthat goes on to say, do not heckle, do not malign some of the best and brightest if they say, yes, I will go work for Donald Trump, even if you didn't like Donald Trump. And Ross Douthat, as a Republican, as a conservative, was in the never Trump category. He didn't really think this was possible, but it's here now. And he's saying we have to hope for the good people to be there for him. You agree?
I absolutely agree. I think that that's the only hope going forward, that he is not allowed to surround himself with the sorts of people who would be likely to support his worst instincts, but instead that the process of negotiating with Congress leads to appointments of people who have sufficient weight to be able to resist some of these instincts and sufficient authority to be able to convince him to act otherwise.
Well, let's just play totally hypothetical here. He calls you tomorrow. President-elect Trump is on the phone, and Randy Stone, he's read some of your work. He's talked to people you've consulted with here in Washington and Moscow. He loves your mind. He wants you there in Washington.
I think I'm safe on those grounds because I'm a Democrat.
Team of rivals. He's team of rivals. He could call you.
I was afraid you might ask me that. There's a terrifying prospect, but no, I don't think I could serve Donald Trump.
You don't think you could do it. But
I hope that someone can.
You certainly hope that strong and experienced people will do that. Okay. Let's get our only break of the hour, and I want to come back. I've got a few of your questions lined up already on email, edawson@wxxi.org. We'll get to some of those. You can find me on Twitter @EvanDawson. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. We'll continue the discussion on international trade and finance. I've got a couple questions on that. We'll talk about Middle Eastern policy. Climate change is part of this discussion, I think, and that has to be said. He's already made one appointment when it comes to the EPA that indicates that his rhetoric on the campaign trail is very much not this chimera, that this is exactly how he feels, that climate change is not a real concern. But we'll continue that discussion with Dr. Randy Stone from the University of Rochester next. Coming up in our second hour, Rochester is reviewing its nuisance abatement program. That program is designed to take out drug dens and problem properties, properties that become kind of havens for crime in neighborhoods, the kinds of properties that drag down neighborhoods. But is the program being used fairly and effectively? Former Mayor Bill Johnson is helping lead that review, and he's my guest next hour on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and Sandy wants to push back on something that Randy said in the first hour. One of our listeners named Sandy, she says, Evan, I'm sure that any U.S. presidential candidate was in touch with all heads of other countries, including Russia. Also saying that John Bolton, the neocon war hawk, may be a good Secretary of State is beyond the pale. I guess that you are agreeing that we must, for U.S. interests, retain the status quo as far as foreign policy. She says, by the way, I did not vote for Trump or Hillary because I did not want my country to continue on being the imperialistic, bellicose country that it has been for too damn long. That's from Sandy. So a couple of points there. You want to elaborate a little bit? She says, John Bolton, to say that he could be a good Secretary of State is beyond the pale. So.
Well, I wouldn't say that he would be a good Secretary of State. Just imagining of all the sorts of things that Trump might attempt to do, it would be reassuring to American allies to have someone who was a well-known figure from the past, who was associated with something very different. These appointments are fraught with these sorts of dilemmas, and I would not be happy about that, but I don't expect to be happy about Trump appointees.
Okay. And then Sandy's comment is very different than another emailer's comment about contact with Russia during the campaign. Sandy writes, I'm sure that any U.S. presidential candidate was in touch with all heads of other countries, including Russia. In other words, big deal that Russia's deputy foreign minister is saying that there was contact between the Russian government and the Trump campaign during the campaign. But here's John emailing the program saying, if it's true that Russia had an influence on our election and that the Trump campaign was contacted by them, wouldn't that be treason? Doesn't our intelligence community and law enforcement have an obligation to investigate these charges? So John and Sandy, very different perspectives on that. What would you say to them, Randy?
Yeah, I don't think that being in contact with a foreign government during the campaign would be treasonous, but I don't think it's typical at all. And particularly to have contact with a government that is so antagonistic towards the United States at the current time. It's typical that there are for example, the interaction that happened over the summer with Mexico, which was very controversial in Mexico, was initiated apparently by the Mexican government, and it was in response to things that Donald Trump had said and so forth. There's nothing that's illegal about that, but it's unusual. It's not the norm for presidential campaigns to be spending their time trying to engage in foreign policy.
Okay, but to Sandy's question, and you go back to 2008 with Barack Obama, Mitt Romney traveled. Donald Trump, as you said, met with the Mexican president. I thought the Mexican president embarrassed himself a little bit with the fealty that he showed there. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is, contact with head of state from candidates is not beyond the pale. I think the question is there anything that approaches collusion, influence, et cetera? Fair?
So there were other issues, okay. I think, that raised that question. And it did appear to be the case that the Russian government was supporting cyber hacking, which was intended to undermine Hillary Clinton's campaign. And it's clear that the Russian government had a strong preference that Hillary Clinton lose this campaign. But I guess I don't see anything about having had contacts between the campaign and the Russian government that rises to the level of treason.
Okay. And the phone is really ringing now, so let me get through a couple of your phone calls as well. John in Pittsford. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I think you're misrepresenting the quote. Sergei Rybakov said there had been contact with the immediate entourage. That's the quote from the New York Times. And then they further defined it to mean American politicians and supporters of Mr. Trump, not members of the campaign staff. And then the Trump campaign went on to deny that there were any contacts with the campaign.
Sure.
So let's not debate about contacts with the campaign when there's absolutely nobody saying that but you.
Well, John, just as to point out how murky this gets, is Corey Lewandowski part of the Trump campaign? He was technically not part of the Trump campaign. He got paid by CNN for the last several months of the campaign, and yet every other day someone saw him going into Trump Tower. He clearly had. So there are a lot of people who may not be on the campaign payroll who the Russian government could be in touch with. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm simply pointing out that it gets murky in terms of who's working for whom. But I'm not at all saying it's treasonous or it's beyond the pale.
No, you're saying, though, there's enough problems with Trump's foreign policy without trying to stretch the comment. The comment is that there was contact with the immediate entourage, and it was not members of the campaign. They were politicians and supporters.
Sure.
Now,
okay.
Now you want to say there are, maybe the supporters were members of the campaign, but you got to acknowledge in this discussion that you are making that jump now.
Oh no! I listen, John. I think you make a very good point, and I'm glad you called. No, I'm not at all sitting in this chair agreeing with someone like Charles Pearson Esquire or other writers who've said this merits immediate congressional investigation. I understand some of the concern about what Randy Stone just raised, which is that possible Russian influence on hacking, that U.S. I believe U.S. intelligence agencies have made conclusions independent of campaign actors here, right, Randy? I
mean, that's right. A number of U.S. Intelligence agencies have been unusually explicit in saying that this was traceable to Russian organizations.
Sure.
that were connected to the state agencies.
Yeah, sure. But John in Pittsburgh, thanks for the call, and I certainly take the point. And I appreciate that. Let me just go ahead and read an email from a listener named Zach who just wants to know what would be the most harmful trade deal to rip up if one were to be ripped up tomorrow. A lot of talk about TPP and NAFTA. Randy Stone, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, TPP seems to be dead on delivery. I think as someone who, sees a lot of benefit from international trade, doesn't expect trade deals to be perfect. I think the TPP was probably the best one that we had negotiated. It was, in terms of the left-right spectrum, it was the furthest to the left. It was most concerned with labor rights, climate concerns, environmental issues. And, of course, corporations had gotten a lot of the things that they wanted in that process, but it was an unusually Democratic as opposed to Republican trade deal. But that one's done for. I don't think the damage in economic terms is very great because it wasn't actually implemented. You might argue that the geopolitical damage is significant, that this is a real blow to an American strategy that had tried to bolster alternatives to Chinese control of Southeast Asia. And that, a number of our allies had really gone out on a limb to support this rather controversial treaty at home, and now they've been left in the lurch. So the United States, if it tries this sort of diplomacy in the future, will find it harder because we showed ourselves to be unreliable. The one that's really economically most important is NAFTA. And it's interesting that even Hillary Clinton didn't want to defend NAFTA very full-throatedly on the campaign trail because it's become unpopular. But NAFTA has been a very successful trade deal for the United States and for Mexico. And it the degree of interconnections between our economies now are so great that in some sense it's irreversible. Right. The investments that have been made and the value chains that have been built that go back and forth and back and forth across the border have really integrated our economies to a degree that would be very, very costly to dismantle. But I just discovered, looking back over the documentation of NAFTA, that President of the United States can actually unilaterally withdraw from NAFTA. All he has to do is give 60 days notice. He does not need any congressional support in order to do that, which is shocking and unusual. Most treaties to be overturned have to be overturned by Congress. The president can propose to withdraw from it, but needs congressional support. That's why treaties are a kind of political commitment device. But NAFTA was written in this way, that it can be triggered by the president. So if President Trump wants to abolish NAFTA, he can do that.
This is a discussion for a whole other hour. NAFTA on its own is. But mm-hmm. Let me at least ask you a follow-up, because what we certainly see in this campaign, and I understand why, is there are many millions of Americans, working class Americans, who might hear the kind of comment you make, which is that NAFTA has been largely successful for the U.S. and Mexico, and they say, prove it. On what grounds? How do you justify that kind of statement?
Well, exports from the United States to Mexico have gone up by a factor of about 4. Exports from Mexico to the United States have gone up by a factor of about 5. The Mexico is now our third largest trading partner after Canada and China. So our automobile industry is very deeply intertwined with Mexico. It came up during the campaign that Ford was moving its production of the Ford Focus to Mexico, and that roused a lot of concerns. But at the same time, Ford was repurposing the facility where it currently produces the Ford Focus to produce SUVs, which have a higher markup, and was expanding employment and in production in Michigan. So it's a very mixed bag. Part of what has allowed the big three automakers to continue to be competitive internationally is that they have diversified their value chains, and they do production of certain sorts of products overseas, and then they bring them back to the United States. So they wouldn't be able to compete with other automobile companies that do that in other parts of the world if they didn't do some of that as well.
Would you agree that the language of globalization took a beating in this campaign, and that there's going to have to be some real discussion going forward about not only the merits of globalization where they exist, but maybe some of the warts, and where there are merits, a not condescending, a careful conversation with the American public about it? Because a lot of people feel that it's hurt.
That's absolutely true. Globalization is less popular right now than it has been any time during my lifetime. I think the problem is that people have taken a high standard of living that's made possible by international trade for granted. They don't realize where this is coming from. And they imagine that all of the dislocations that they observe are attributable to international trade. But most of the dislocations in manufacturing are actually attributable to technological change, rather than to trade per se. So our choice is not really one of returning to a golden era when manufacturing was booming and wages were high and so forth. The choice is whether there will be some manufacturing in the United States that's globally integrated with the rest of the world and competitive and on the cutting edge of technology, or whether that manufacturing will disappear because we refuse to participate in the International Division of Labor.
While we hope to return to a town worth 65,000 people employed by a single company, which is not in the offing. Is that fair?
Well, that's true. Kodak is not coming back.
Well, Kodak or otherwise, in terms of a single employer of 65,000 people here. But I hope to find some books and some really sort of meaty papers that I can read to help us understand globalization going forward that will be, I think, publicly digestible and good for all of us to help understand it. Because I think what we've seen in the last 18 months is there's a lot of anger and suspicion. So let me get back to your phone calls. Jane in Rochester. Go ahead, Jane.
This is what really disturbs me when you talk about globalization. You just mentioned, your guest just mentioned, Ford relocating in Mexico. And then it follows that with saying, well, most of the jobs that have been lost are due to technology. So are you saying that the jobs that were moved to Mexico could not be done here because of some sort of technology that you can do in Mexico, but you can't do here? And I just see that as very disingenuous. I think there's offshoring because you don't have to respect anything like OSHA. You can pay cheap labor. There's a whole list of things that help to benefit, make wealthy these corporations. And then the people who lose their jobs here, we are collateral damage. And if NAFTA was so great, you can look locally here that the population is said to be 50% in poverty. And a lot of those people have lost jobs and cannot get jobs because their jobs are in other countries now.
All right, Jane, thanks for the phone call. Randy, go ahead.
Well, these issues are very complex, and much of what the caller, Jane, said is absolutely correct. Part of the reason that multinational corporations are interested in moving operations abroad is to avoid what they find as worrisome labor regulations here, and the regulations that we have to protect workers, to protect the environment, and so on. And I think it's very important going forward that trade negotiations be carried out with an eye to trying to reinforce those sorts of concerns. And that's one reason why I saw the TPP as a real sign of progress, because the Obama administration had done much more of that than was typical in the past. But NAFTA also included a lot of important labor protections and a lot of important environmental protections, and it has raised the standards of living of workers in Mexico very dramatically and improved their abilities to represent their interests. But it's a mixed bag. It's complex. But the comment about technology was an aggregate comment.
Sure.
About what's sweeping the economy as a whole and why there are so many fewer manufacturing jobs as a whole, as opposed to the microeconomic comment about that particular firm.
So sure, sure.
That firm moved in order to save money.
And Jane, I think it may be helpful, and I'll try to find a source on this, but I read in the Washington Post earlier this year, we are actually manufacturing more stuff in this country than in a long time, but we are employing fewer people to do it. And that's just part of what technology, automation, this is all part of the complex puzzle that Randy is talking about. The New York Times writes the following: Donald Trump cited Carrier again and again on the campaign trail, threatening to phone executives at the company and its parent, United Technologies, to hit them with 35% tariffs on any furnaces and air conditioners they imported from Mexico. To the cheers of his supporters, he predicted at rallies that Carrier would call him up as president and say, "Sir, we've decided to stay in the United States," end quote. And he's going to say, "Randy Stone, you better eat crow if they do that."
Well, I don't dispute that as president, Trump can push firms around and get them to change their decisions. I think he definitely can do that in a few cases. I don't think that he can accomplish what he claimed he could do on the campaign trail and just bring back millions of manufacturing jobs to the United States.
Are you concerned that he could pick one target like a Carrier or someone else, almost, you know, pin it on the wall and say, look at this win as an optical idea as opposed to a broader policy that is bringing back millions of jobs?
I actually hope that instead of some of the sweeping rhetoric that mm-hmm. he's talked about, he picks out a few optical examples, gets a few symbolic wins, mm-hmm. and then doesn't cause a whole lot of damage. So, for example, on China, he has raised the bar for his administration on really accomplishing something with China. If he does something impose some anti-dumping duties or something.
Or 35% tariffs, as he said.
Right, right. well, anti-dumping 30 duties can be as high as 235% on particular goods and so forth. But as long as they don't cover the whole economy, they're not going to cause the Chinese economy to collapse. And it's not going to then bring about a financial crisis, right, that we then have to cope with all sorts of spillover in other countries. So small symbolic moves might be vastly preferable to some of the things he said he wants to do.
All right, John in Rochester next up. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Randy. You know, I have to say, I've been reading the last couple of days, they've been talking about this ban and being ultra right wing and everything, and I kind of laugh because Obama appointed a lot of leftists to his cabinet, and his confidant Valerie Jarrett is a real leftist. So I think it kind of balances out a little bit. But my question, Randy, is I support most of what Trump has said in regards to policy, except for the tariff issue. What concerns me is that Herbert Hoover and even FDR tried to solve our economic crisis back then with putting high tariffs on it. It was a failure. Now, Trump does respect guys like Larry Kudlow and a number of other economists who I think will talk some sense into him. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'll just deal with that last question. I'm very hopeful that cooler minds will prevail, and that the people who make it through the process of, you know, negotiating with the Senate and being confirmed and so forth will be cautious, will not want to upset the apple cart, kill the golden goose, whatever your favorite metaphor is, and realize that, you know, that we've gone too far down the road of integration with the rest of the world economy to be able to extract ourselves from that without leading to a very deep and very prolonged depression. Right, that would be worldwide. So I think the instinct that that's unlikely because it's such a bad outcome is probably correct, but it's a lot more likely than it used to be.
And regards to Steve Bannon, John, let me just say this: Steve Bannon's website Breitbart has a tag for news stories on black crime. Steve Bannon wrote this past summer that of course police are going to be in more violent confrontations with African Americans because some people are naturally prone to more aggression. That is a comment about black people in our world. I take the point that the comments of his ex-wife about their divorce proceedings, that maybe he didn't say those things about Jewish people at his kid's school. Maybe he did. But the point is, to sit there and say Steve Bannon right, Valerie Jarrett left, is a little reductive and silly. And Steve Bannon is not sort of your garden variety right, leaning person in the White House. I think that's important to say that. Chris on Twitter, real quick, just wants to know, Randy, as a negotiating tactic, isn't it rational to make allies nervous in order to encourage them to pay more for their own defense?
If your top priority is to get more money out of them, it might be a tactic that will work. And I suspect that by threatening to suspend NAFTA, he can get some negotiating leverage vis-a-vis Mexico. Threatening to withdraw support from NATO allies can give us a bit of leverage vis-a-vis NATO allies. But American foreign policy has always been based on reassurance and credibility. And that's what has allowed us to accomplish things in the long run. And we've accomplished some amazing things. We've kept Japan from developing nuclear weapons. We've managed to prevent a flare-up on the Korean Peninsula. We've managed to create a remarkably integrated and cooperative international economic order, which has led to tremendous, unprecedented prosperity and development in the developing world. Those sorts of things can only be done through a strategy of commitment, not a strategy of saying, well, maybe I'll just take my toys and go home.
And in 20 seconds, it was Hillary Clinton in 2008 campaigning against Barack Obama who did the 3 a.m. phone call ad saying he's going to be tested, he's unsure, international actors will see an unsure president, they'll test him. And in, I think people are wondering now, is a President Trump more likely to be tested because of how he's viewed around the world as potentially reacting more quickly, less coolly?
I think we already see signs of that from Russia and China.
I hope you'll come back and help us understand these issues going forward. It's nice to see you.
Thanks, Evan.
Randy Stone, thank you for being here, the director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. It's got a lot of great colleagues in this town as well, and we'll continue to have these discussions on foreign policy. Short break, more connections next.